This is the second half of my conversation with Doug Lane from round about January the 5th, 2015. The first part being the first podcast in the Zero Squared series. This part of the audio picks up just after my description of the difficulty of being a spellbreaker as opposed to a culture maker, the risk that by disrupting the culture through creating subversive art and subversive messages, I might just be increasing the culture's immune system.
Describing reminds me of, and I've just recently been finishing up reading Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit with a guy named Andy Marshall, who is a dedicated fan and listener to the podcast that preceded this one, Diet Soap. And what I, you know, it's a big, difficult book, but one thing I recall from it is that at a certain stage in his Phenomenology of Spirit, and which Hegel is laying out the kind of the history of consciousness. It's one way of thinking of the Phenomenology of Spirit. You get to a point where the creative force in society is reluctant to impose itself onto the world because it is afraid of losing itself in the process. That whatever whatever it creates, whatever impulse or vision that the creative force has in itself, once made external, will immediately become something other than itself, and that will therefore you'll be alienated from it, regardless of how well the original idea is being acted out in the world. It could be perfectly well. And probably that would be the worst thing, because you lose every part of your original vision to the world.
Wasn't it a bit like a father having a child? I mean, that's something internal creative that comes outside and creates another, and then the other, of course, ends up being generally at odds with the creator.
It is a bit like that, only... having a child is on the level of biology and the animal, and whereas by the time you get to this part of the phenomenology, you're talking about on the level of culture and politics. So you're talking about creating values rather than creating animals.
Yeah, although I think. Because culture, of course, the word has a biological meaning, and I do tend to, I guess this is my body philosophy, I do tend to think that everything can be reduced to biological processes, or at least maybe not reduced, but that they can superimpose any kind of social phenomenon whatsoever on a biological model, and it will be a close fit.
Okay, well, I guess I tend to agree with you in a sense, because I want to be a materialist. But on the other hand, I think our values are never quite a perfect match for our biology.
Well, there's certainly conflict.
I think that not only do they conflict, but that simply to have values, which is sort of biologically necessary for human beings, means that you're going to be putting your biology into conflict with your
I'm
idea.
I'm not sure it is biology. I mean, I don't going to get sidetracked I would question that is a biologically necessary.
Right. Well, maybe we can talk.
You mean values as in which plants are edible and which aren't, but I would see that not as value, but as, you know, as factual kind of knowledge.
I don't know. I would say, like, value, that fantasies and large cultural desires and all of that is sort of biologically necessary, because you have to have ways of coordinating human labor to work together, and you have to have common projects, you know? Go ahead.
Bees, they don't have value, as far as we know. I mean, it could have a bee manifesto right. under the hive. So.
Yeah, but that's just one way in which we are biologically different than bees. You know, with bees don't have, imaginations, as far as we know. And they don't require, somehow they can operate, you know, on the level of instinct and create these systems that we require, you know, language and culture to produce.
Yeah, I think it's true about imagination. I think imagination is a faculty that separates us from the animals, and that it has a purpose that we don't understand. I would just say that creating values is a misuse of the imagination, perhaps. But this, I'm an idealist, you see. I somehow like to imagine a world in which human beings exist without any culture or social structures or anything, even though I can't imagine it. But
right.
I'm working
right,
on it.
Right. Well,
I'm not a servant of culture. I'm trying not to be, anyway, in both senses, in that I don't serve the culture. I'm not, in the employ of it, not working for it. But also I don't want to serve culture up to people. I don't just want to offer more culture to distract them. That's my aspiration, anyway. So, but the agreement of culture is, and of writing and of filmmaking and of all the rest of it, is tacit agreement, is that you will serve the culture, that you will prop up the narratives that are already out there. So for me as a writer, for example, to choose to write, and you brought this up about Boyhood, you know, why do I choose to attack a film that people love? Well, there's your answer, because I could say obsession, but my dharma, you know, somewhere between dharma and obsession, vocation and obsession, is to break the spells that I see people are under, to be truly subversive. Mm-hmm. But that is, as you're saying it or getting at, that goes against the survival instinct, really. You know, I'm never going to be a popular writer that way. I'm never going to get embraced by the culture. I may never have more than a handful of readers at any time, and that drives me nuts.
Yeah, well, you know, there are some exceptions. I mean, it does happen that people who are, you know, exactly as critical and, you know, rebellious as you, and even more so, get heralded as great artists and great champions of the culture.
But my problem with that, Doug, is if that happened, I would probably think that I had sold out unconsciously.
Right. I was just going to say, the only thing that would be worse than what's happening to you now is for you to succeed, right? But
seems that way, yeah.
But
anyway, yeah, bring it back to the manifesto.
Yeah, right.
One thing that came to mind is that, because you're talking about intellectual critical inquiry, and that one thing I've encountered with this Kubrick project is that there's a certain kind of critical inquiry which is actually less intellectual and more imaginative, which I find personally is much more effective, like using the imagination to question and not just the intellect. And that really does, people have a really difficult time, like even understanding what I'm saying. I will make points very clearly intellectually, But because there's a very heavy dose of imagination, you probably maybe notice this in my writing, it's very intuitive and it makes these leaps. They actually don't get it, and they'll come back and they'll argue with points that I never made, because the intellect just has to paper over the cracks, and it's got to somehow make it make sense at an intellectual level if, you know, if it's not willing to surrender or secede to the imagination. But my point being, bringing this up, is I think that, I mean, my feeling about the Zero Books Manifesto, I enjoy the fact that it's got a lot of attitude. I like that.
Uh-huh.
It's got attitude, and I respond to that because I'm a bit like that too, like kind of tough guy voice. But it does seem to be defined by negatives a little bit,
uh-huh.
as in it's opposed to something rather than presenting something new that isn't a reaction or an opposition to something already existing. And I would link that maybe to the emphasis on intellect and as opposed to imagination, that the imagination is more powerful than the intellect, I think.
Well,
in terms of, you know, changing values.
Yeah, it's funny because I think it's funny that you would say that, and I don't disagree entirely, but the imagination without intellect is the realm of narcissistic self-gratification. It's the identification with a myth, and, you know, I'll stop there because I've run out of good words. But the intellect is that moment where you turn around and look at the rear projector, you know?
Well, no, because you need the imagination even to imagine that there is such a thing as a rear projector. It's not a logical deduction, but I agree. They have to work together. If you divorce them, then they're both forms of dissociation, I think. Different, very different kinds.
Okay, I think you have to be able to imagine that there is something, a reason for something that isn't immediately in front of you. But to me, is an intellectual imagination. It's not...
or an imaginative intellect.
Yeah, either way, yeah. Well, yeah, so I think one of the tasks would be to think about and try to figure out what it means to be an intellectual today, and just what the balance or relationship between, say, scientific rationalism and the imagination would be. You look at a book like The Enlightenment Interrupted, that Zero put out recently, as a key maybe to understanding what Zero is after, or what I would want Zero Books to be after, which is to try to think our way and create our way towards a resolution to the problems that came up through the Enlightenment and that we've yet to resolve, to finish the French Revolution.
See, I would take the problem, I would trace it way further back.
Yeah.
Like the Garden of Eden.
Right. You would trace it all the way back to somewhere that's imaginary.
No, I would actually trace it back to the inception of language, which is not quite imaginary, but we don't have a historical timeline for that.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would say, yeah, language is... I wouldn't say the problem, because that's oversimplifying it, but I can't think of a way to say it that isn't oversimplifying.
No, I know, I understand what... But see, I think all these... I think the problem of... language is a problem, or the social realm as a problem, is something that maybe... started in the way we know it after the French Revolution. The way we look back to the prehistory has changed due to modern history, and that, you know, that the question of can we return to some sort of original way of life, and have that original way of life be free of myths and superstition.
So it may not be a return then.
It may not be a return, but
because it may never have been. Though.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that there's a tendency for us to, as we try to escape myth and superstition, to try to find something original, that predates myth and superstition, basically to go back before the fall in one way or another. And which shows that the Enlightenment Project itself had a mythic component, had a superstition in it to begin with. So
I think it's, at least my idea, my imagining is it's so much simpler than that, and movies is a great metaphor. It's simply cancelling our agreement, our unconscious agreement, to suspend disbelief, just to stop believing in the narrative, whether it's the Garden of Eden or the Bible, or whether it's the Enlightenment, or whether it's capitalism, or whatever, or it's the ego. Just stop believing. Because it really is belief, I believe, that upholds that narrative, or that upholds that reality. Like, if we didn't believe in it, it wouldn't be able to sustain itself.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, what the one of the things that I'm glad for is that we will be able to get into the nitty-gritty about that question in future podcasts. It's not an easy question to try to resolve, because I don't disagree with you about the nature of belief. In other words, an intellectual stance towards belief is that you shouldn't hold them, right? That you should always hold your beliefs at least somewhat at a distance from yourself, because they're always to be open to revision. That's like the scientific position on the world. And so I agree. But then there are other people, there are thinkers that I've read, like Althusser, who point out that ideology, which is basically an unconsciously adopted set of values and beliefs that help you work in the world, that set up a social system, that ideology is always necessary. That even to start to get a distance from beliefs necessitates that you already have been indoctrinated into a system. And that, you know, in your example of the autist, the autistic person, is someone who maybe challenges Althusser's argument. You know, as an exception to that, someone who doesn't get indoctrinated in. But the question becomes, how effective is the severe autist or autistic person in really being able to question and challenge beliefs?
You mean at a social
level? On a social level.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm not. I mean, I'm very interested in social questions, but I don't see it as a goal. Like changing the social structures, I don't see as a goal, because I see that as another narrative, you know, that I've been conditioned to believe in.
Right, and
I mean, it's very hard to talk about these things without getting mystical. But it's not mystical, I don't think, to say that the context that all of this is taking place within is eternity. Like endless time, and that everything we say and everything we do and everything we are as a species will eventually be reduced to nothing, no traces.
Right.
And that's reality. That is the reality, capital R.
Right.
And that's the kind of ground that I'm trying to stay aware of, even if I can't quite find it, because I can't hold that awareness and consciousness for more than a split second at a time. Without losing all will to live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and well, see, this is an interesting. It's interesting to do this podcast as opposed to the Diet Soap podcast, because in a way that I've never had when I was doing Diet Soap, I have this sense of an audience with expectations. Mm. Like, so we've walked into this realm, which I think is actually really important to talk about, and which we've talked about lots of times. What, like, one of the things that I was thinking about mentioning was that, you know, Zero Books is published as an imprint in a line of John Hunt books, and you know, it's one imprint amongst many, and most of the other imprints have a new age character. Not all of them by any means, but I would say the majority of them do. And I think that Zero Books has to kind of take account of the fact that for a lot of the working class, or a lot of the everyday folks, the outside of the academy, if you're looking to find a nonfiction book that deals with philosophical issues, most people are going to gravitate towards New Age and self-help before they turn to books on, you know, ideology, critique, Zizek, or, you know, Deleuze, or object-oriented ontology. And, you know, those books sell better, and that's where the intellectual is in our culture today. And
In the New Age.
Yeah, in the New Age, in the that's self-help realm. I mean, or in the academy.
There's a sort of psychology is kind of a little bit of an in-between era, isn't it? You don't have to be too hardcore to be reading Hillman, say.
Right. Yeah. And there are, you know, there are gradations there. I mean, if you go to the psychology section and you're reading a book on Jungian psychology, say, you could end up reading a New Age self-help book in that section. You could end up reading something that's leaning towards the academic. But finding a book that is neither of those things on that subject is really tricky. There aren't many. And that's what Zero Books is aiming to be. But I think in order to do that, you'd have to take a stance towards the New Age and the self-help movement and figure out why it's kicking your ass in terms of being the place that people turn to for ideas.
For positive life-affirming messages.
Yeah, for ideas about how to live a good life, about how to be in the world.
Which is what everyone wants.
Mm-hmm.
A good life. Yeah.
Right, well, the alternative is a bad one.
but I guess
or
risk of harping on
the other alternative is like a life thing, the other is pie in the sky when you die. That's the third alternative there, right? I mean, you don't have to have a good life now. You can get right with God and then expect for.
But isn't that what most people see as a good life? Really, is a life where they feel that it's good and it's virtuous and somehow it has meaning, as opposed to just an authentic life where they're fully in the moment and fully experiencing whether it's good or bad. You know? I know that's kind of part of the New Age philosophy.
Yeah, well, I kind of tend to think that living life in the moment without judgment, that the whole...
I didn't say the bit about without judgment.
Well, no, but without judging whether it's good or bad.
Right or wrong for oneself is very different from referring to some external value system, whether it's Christianity or Marxism or New Ageism,
right,
to tell you whether it's good or bad. I mean, those are they're totally diametrically opposed things, like an internal versus an external value system.
Right, but the problem is, and from the beginning here, we've already determined that our whole sense of self relies on things that come from outside. From the very beginning, we don't get a sense of self until we have a relationship with, whether it's popular culture or religion or something else, a relationship with a mythic structure that's outside of us, that is imposed upon us by those who came before, mom and dad.
Well, that's how it's been. Yeah, that's how it's been for millennia. But I don't think we can deduce or conclude from that the only way to experience oneself is using those things to create an identity. Just that's always the way we've done it.
Right. Well, you know, this, and so here's the difference between like someone who looks at the human psyche as basically, from a Freudian perspective, basically an Oedipal subject, meaning that by definition you're kind of split off from direct power. You're always alienated from yourself. You're never going to be whole. That's the Freudian perspective on the psyche, and a Jungian one, which holds out a promise for wholeness to be re-achieved, I think. So I'm sort of more on the Freudian side of things. That doesn't necessarily, you know, I can't. That's. But the thing about that is, going back to the New Age, spiritual self-help side, I would not claim that being on the Freudian side of things helps me live a better life. You know, that doesn't necessarily make me happier or more well-adjusted or more even equipped to deal with problems. So I don't know what good it does there for me, you know. But I feel like it seems to be, my intellect tells me that's the more solid argument, that we're all edible subjects, you know.
Does that allow for a spectrum, though? As in, there are, even though you can't ever be completely whole, there are people who are closer to being whole than other people.
I think it's a matter of, there are people who, well, there's a couple of different things. I think there are people who are more satisfied and less neurotic than others. And I think there are also people who are more aware of their fractured nature and who are therefore closer to understanding the truth of themselves. But I don't know, the problem with the real revelation at the end of a psychoanalysis, which I've never been through, so I'm only using my imagination here, is that I don't know if you're given any tools to judge who is closer to having the real values, you know, who's closer to being
that's
whole.
True. And maybe that was the wrong question then. Maybe the question is, like, in your own experience, is there a spectrum, as in you have found yourself coming closer to what I would probably call self-acceptance rather than wholeness?
Oh, yeah. I do think that you can come closer to self-acceptance. And getting older, I think just one of the nice things about it is that you end up doing that, I think, maybe regardless of your life experience. Somehow you just don't have the energy to hate yourself that much after a while. So it's just easier to
yeah,
let go of
that.
I
do think they go hand in hand, those things. It's not getting older necessarily, but being disillusioned and just more and more fed up with one's own internal narratives and just not being able to believe in them as much. That is disillusionment, right? Freedom from illusion. And it's a big question for me, as I think you know. I've pursued enlightenment, you know, on and off my whole life, and or under one name or another. So, and the question is, you know, just because there does seem to be a spectrum where one is closer to wholeness or self-acceptance or individuation, rather than further from it, does that mean there's an end point in which self-acceptance / individuation is complete? I just deduce that there is, because, you know, everything's finite, to quote David Byrne, my last remaining hero. Everything's finite, right? Mm. So then if there's a spectrum, there must be an end point. I mean, I don't know that, but I just deduce that. But I do think, you know, trying to move towards that end point, that is contrary to self-acceptance, of course. Mm-hmm. So I think that the end point is only ever reached by accepting that one will never reach it. And then maybe one doesn't even notice it when one reaches it. I can't remember what we're talking about now. What was the larger context?
I don't know. I guess the larger context was whether or not the aim of something like Zero Books at changing society was itself a way of denying the reality of our existence, which is that it's fleeting at best, and that even if we manage to changed society dramatically. There's no heroic project that's going to redeem us in the end.
No, and it's the whole thing of displacement activities, right? Is, you know, all culture, according to Ernest Becker and Denial of Death, but I think he was onto something, is, you know, created as a reaction against the awareness of our death in a way to prop up, shore up the crumbling walls of an identity that knows it's going to die.
Right.
But I mean, that doesn't make it bad. It's just, again, how honestly do we approach whatever project it is, and how realistic is it? So when you were describing that as Zero Books goal, I would say, to me, it would be more honest and more realistic just to talk about individual books. You know, can this book change a reader who reads it in a way that's meaningful?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem necessary to try and extend it further outward. That would seem to be a kind of grandiose vision that would suggest a bit of that Becker denial of death, you know, neurosis of, I've got to feel that what I'm doing is really important.
Right. But, you know, of course, Becker's whole project itself was trying to change society. I mean, in the end, Becker was a social critic. He was not, he didn't have a good solution for the problem he presented, which was a problem of death. He just posited it he basically took it and said, yeah, this problem of death, it's the reason we have this other problem, which is a problem of how to live and how to live with each other socially.
Yeah.
And if we can accept it and learn to cope with death, we will live a better life. And so he changed the whole, what he was trying to solve. He stopped trying to solve the problem of death and tried to solve the problem of life.
So that would count as realism, in my mind.
Yeah.
Like, there are people trying to solve the problem of death still.
Right.
There's many of them out there.
Yeah. And I like those guys. I'm all for them. But I'm not going to, you know, I'll be the first one in line to try the immortality pill. I mean, at least I would be this week. But
right. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not averse to living 1,000 years if that was offered, but I just say it is postponing the problem because, they're going to give the pill to the universe or the sun and, you know, make sure that the sun doesn't die because, you know, it's, you know, just, you know, the human, I think it's combination of imagination and intellect, which is not so productive, is the whole hubris thing where we somehow imagine that we can use our intellect to create a better reality, as if there is a need for that in the first place. And I don't think there would be a need for it if we hadn't been so severely traumatized to begin with, which brings us back to changing the society that's creating trauma.
Yeah.
And I am all for that in some ways, but it's I think that the main problem in our society now is just simply not being addressed. And that's a big statement, and I'd have to back it up. But, I mean, let's just say childbirth. Like, childbirth is trauma-inducing, and, you know, how much energy and attention is being directed to that? I don't think, until you actually get to the root of what's wrong in a society and even just recognize it, and even that wouldn't be the root, because what it is that created those barbaric rituals of childbirth, circumcision could go there. We won't get too controversial on our first podcast, but you know what I mean. I mean, like, there's so many problems in society, but it seems that the root problems are ones. Obviously, they're the ones that affected us as individuals, impacted us, and they're the ones we don't even remember and we don't necessarily even think about when we're addressing social injustice and whatnot.
Well, talking to you, the problem with talking to you for my first podcast is that it leaves me in a position where I have far less, control over which side of my ego construction I present to the world, because we tend to talk deeply, so it's like it gets past, like, you know, let me present, you know, an image of the radical publisher for everybody, so don't worry, this guy's in, you know, it's like, no, dude, Let's instead let's talk about the neurotic real person here. It's okay, though. It's all right. I mean, actually, probably a smart, just even tactically, a smart move to go with, I think. But
well, see, this is my professional unprofessionalism, isn't it? That's even undermining your professional professionalism. Yeah, I can't do it. I mean, I've tried, and I undermine it. I create an identity, present it to the world, and then I tear it down as soon as it's working. It's terrible as far as having an income goes.
Yeah.
It feels more authentic.
Well, here's the thing about it, is that the truth is I'm someone who is divided about what the role of spirituality should be. In my politics, say, and what I mean, you're to the point where you're saying, should politics be a part of my spirituality? You know, what, does that make any sense? But I'm someone who says, you know, should does this side of the human experience need to be addressed? You know, or can we really make a change in the world without accepting or examining the need that people have for spiritual truths, and
or the need that you have as a potential world reformer.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And the very reason I ask that question is because I feel I have that need. So, but I try to get distance from it, right? But projecting it onto other people, those stupid people over there have that need, not me. I can do without it. I don't need water. But no. So yeah. So that's like. Really true. I have that problem in that sense. And but on the other hand, I know what the rules are from the radical left, and one of them is that you're not, you know, unless you're gonna go ahead and be full bore religious, you're not gonna be talking about that side of life very much. And so, and also I know that the first thing you put out it's going to set the tone for how people perceive what you're doing from that point on. So, but you know, what the hell? We'll just, I'll edit this, make it as honest as I can be and as it can be. And I think it's a lot of, there'll be a lot of good stuff to work with. And hopefully it will help get people interested in your book, too.
I hear your cat.
Yeah, my cat wants out now. Hold on, I'll be right back.
You know you're always on my list.
Oh, mother, can you hear?
Then drink some wine, go out and piss.
Oh, mother, can you hear?
Lies, fools, the kitchen circus.
The night becomes a day.
I wanna bring you some of this.